From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. So much going on there and everywhere. Today, the President of the United States got his hands full. He's going to meet with a very friendly Prime Minister of Norway. They're going to talk trade, and they do a lot of business together. He'll also participate in a bilateral lunch. We also know it is draft day for the NFL draft. This has become so exciting because these players can turn around a franchise with the world's most popular sport, or the nation's most popular sport. That'll be soccer. And then Dick Durbin will officially retire, announced he's not running for re-election at 3 o'clock today. Why is that a big deal? The number two in the party, 80 years old. There's a push within the party to change leadership. Will that put more pressure on Schumer to do something else for a living? Mark Thiessen standing by, and Michael Rubin, Director of Policy Analysis for the Middle East Forum, shortly. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
There's a list of issues that we asked people what they felt about. The president is underwater in all but one, and that one is the border. So there's a lot of work to be completed, which if done successfully, I think would dramatically elevate his current approval rate.
Yeah, I would not worry about it, but the poll numbers are not great right now, 100 days in. I think for Trump, when you want to do big things, a lot of times it takes restructuring, it makes people uneasy, and we're talking tariffs. Massive restructuring of the economy and our trade relationship, and the latest on movement with China.
Number two.
I think we have a deal with Russia. We have to get a deal with Zelensky, and I hope that Zelensky, I thought it might be easier to deal with Zelensky. So far, it's been harder, but that's okay. It's all right.
Well, it's harder, but you're asking him to do things, Mr. President, that I don't think he should be asked to do. Emotions are raging in London, and Ukraine and Russia inch closer to a ceasefire deal. Meanwhile, Russia bombs the nation's capital of Kyiv and kills 9 innocent people. And both Rubio and Witkoff mysteriously boycott the talks. We'll see where this all stands.
Number one.
You know, I was supposed to be doing my senior thesis last night and instead was faced by a mob that wouldn't let me walk through my own campus. But unfortunately, not something new for myself or my Jewish peers at Yale.
That is Netanel Crisp, and he is a senior at Yale University. This has got to stop. An Ivy League institution erupts again into anti-Semitic protest, even though Yale was moved to immediate action, and they disbanded the group on campus. They disallow their club now. I get the sense that Trump has got to act and come down hard on this abhorrent unrest, because it doesn't happen overnight. It's got to be embedded in the curriculum. We have the latest, and you'll hear from a Jewish senior himself sometime within this Thursday broadcast. Let's go to Mark Thiessen, Washington Post, chief speechwriter for Bush, and Fox News contributor. Mark, can you believe this happens at Yale? And did you see the masks on the faces of the students? And on camera, a Jewish students get repelled even after all this unrest at Harvard and Columbia?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, if it wasn't for Donald Trump, they wouldn't be disbanding Students for Justice in Palestine on the campus. Yale is looking at Harvard and Columbia and saying, yeah, we don't want to go down that path. But first of all, why are these people allowed to protest in masks? You know, why are you allowed to hide your identity? If you want to protest, then take off your mask and stand up for your principles, and then let us find out who you are and deport you, because a lot of these people are here on student visas, and it's time for us to start cracking down on these student visas and stop letting people into this country who hate America and want to disrupt the lives of our Jewish students who are American citizens.
Name of the group is Yalies for Palestine. Tuesday night, they said they were told, stand down. I don't want to see any protests. We got an Israeli official who's going to be speaking. They were invited. They said, okay, but they did anyway. Then he denied it. And they said, wait, it's on Instagram, you idiots. You're recruiting people to show up and protest. And then we watch this guy, Netanel Crisp, and he's going to be on with us, and he was on with me. I've substituted for Laura last night. This is what he said it's like. This guy's a senior, and he says this has been happening for years. Cut four.
It was horrible. That's the best way to put it. But unfortunately, not something new for myself or my Jewish peers at Yale. This is something we've experienced on and off, almost nonstop, really, for the last 2 years, from last year's encampment to near weekly demonstrations and protests where these students, these thugs, these pro-Hamas supporters take over our university spaces, block us from accessing traversing campus facilities, and most recently, as you just observed last night, stopped us from traversing over our own campus, a communal space that we all pay tuition to be able to use. You know, I was supposed to be doing my senior thesis last night and instead was faced by a mob that wouldn't let me walk through my own campus.
So they said $400 million is frozen at Columbia. And Harvard says, how dare you? I'm suing back. They're coming down on accreditation. They're going to question that. The 501c3 is not going to, shouldn't have a bias if you want to be nonprofit. And they're going to crack down on foreign students' admissions. We'd like to know who you're bringing in, especially when we see these foreign students end up being anti-American, anti-West. Mark, this is getting to the heart of a huge problem.
Well, it's getting to the heart of a huge problem. First of all, people are looking at these figures and saying, I didn't know that we were giving $9 billion a year to Harvard.
You know? Absolutely.
You know, with all the problems we're having, why are we giving $9 billion a year to Harvard? So the first step is, you know, maybe we should rethink how much money we're giving to these elite Ivy League institutions. But even you know, I don't understand Harvard's position because even if you didn't take taxpayer money, you're not allowed to violate federal law. They have an obligation to protect the civil rights of Jewish students on their campuses. You can't allow this stuff to go on. And I think you know, thank God that President Trump is cracking down on these universities because nobody cared about this until their money was at stake. Now they're facing pressure internally mm-hmm. from their own faculty who are saying, why are my grants being cut off? You know, the only thing these people understand is money. And thank God that we're doing something about it.
You know what I want to hear? And I might be wrong. Correct me. Okay, you have all this money and you got to study and you're leading the world and you're a lauded institution. Show me what you've done. Show me what your studies have yielded. And maybe you're going to tell me, you know, you allow people to walk now, but I think that's Elon Musk putting chips in brains. I like to know. And then where is that money going? You have billions of dollars. Say you need it. Go, okay, fine. Where is it? I mean, is it going to people's salaries? How big is your faculty? How big is your staff? I want them to justify this funding money and these study money, because no one's ever done that. So I want to move on. Just to show you, there's another side of this. I think it's an illogical side. Ron Brownstein from CNN. Cut it.
He is going after what has been the foundation of our technological strategy, really, since Sputnik in the 50s. You know, the federal government, sometimes we've heard from the White House press secretary the argument that universities don't deserve public funding. The public funding for universities for research is not some favor we're doing for the universities. The federal government, for more than half a century, has been relying on them to deliver a service to the country and the public.
Okay, we like to know what that is. Is that too much to ask?
Yeah, and also, you know, I don't think it was Harvard that invented a rocket that could land. It was Elon Musk. It was the private sector. The idea that, like, government and academia are the engines of American innovation is absurd. They do basic research. They help but it's the private sector that is the end driver of innovation. And on top of that, to drive innovation, you don't have to charge the taxpayers 69%. For administrative costs on top of the grant, which is what Harvard was doing. There's not a charity in the world that gets away with charging 69% from its donors for administrative costs. Why are American tech? You can make an argument that we should be supporting research that Harvard or Columbia are doing. Fine. Why are we paying for their administrative costs? Why are we paying for the administrators who are failing to protect Jewish students on their campuses? We don't need this. We don't need to support their administrative infrastructure. So, you know, there's a lot. Elon and the Doge have lifted up a lot of rocks, and we're seeing a lot of creepy crawlies under there that they wish we weren't seeing. And it's time to fix it.
All right. So let's talk about Ukraine. There's ceasefire talks in London, and we're hearing that Rubio and Witkoff decided not to go. They're getting fed up with, I think, the wrong side. This is what we understand is the offer that Trump put on the table with collaboration. Russia would get formal U.S. recognition of Crimea, de facto recognition of Russia's occupied four regions in eastern Ukraine, lifting sanctions to boost Russia's economy, opportunities for more economic development. What Ukraine gets, assistance in post-war rebuilding, navigation rights to the Dnipro River. Russia would return a small portion of Ukraine's Kharkiv Oblast area, assistance from U.S. military as a robust security guarantee, not including us. So for Zelensky, he says, no, it's a no-go. I'm never going to acknowledge that they took to our land and they can have it. And there's a way around that, but your thoughts?
Well, number one, he wasn't being asked to acknowledge it. The U.S. was saying that we would acknowledge Russian sovereignty over Crimea, but not over those other territories. It would be what's called de jure recognition in Crimea, de facto recognition of their control of the territories that they've conquered in eastern Ukraine. I don't like recognizing Crimea. I don't think that's a good idea. We never recognized Russia's occupation of the Baltic states during the entire Cold War. We did recognize East Germany, so we recognized the communist takeover of half of Germany at some point. So, I don't understand why that would be a deal breaker for Zelensky when you would be getting security guarantees, rebuilding, there would be compensation for all the damage that was done to Ukraine. And you'd have peace and a chance to have a minerals deal with the United States and all the rest of it. So, here's the problem is that Zelensky keeps miscalculating, because what his answer should be, yes, in principle, but we need to negotiate some of these details, but we're very happy with that the U.S. is putting a proposal on the table. Let Putin reject it. Because which apparently he has, by the way, today, has said no. Because one of the things that's in there is that there would be an international force on the ground of peacekeepers to guarantee to patrol the DMZ. That's great for Ukraine. I think what Trump should do is, in addition to this, is offer them an arms sale package. Not aid, but sell them weapons. The Ukrainians want to buy 10 Patriot systems. Let's sell it to them. It's great for us to have have a foreign military.
Absolutely. Arm them up.
Yeah. Arm them up, because the only way – here's the danger for Trump, right? So Ukraine looks at this and they say, when Obama was president, Russia invaded. Then Trump came into office and they stopped. Then Biden came in and they invaded again. So what's to stop Russia from invading 4 years from now when Trump leaves office, especially if he's succeeded by some weak president like Obama and Biden? Russia could take a four-year pause to rebuild its military, to strengthen its economy with the sanctions relief, and then start this whole thing all over again. The only way you prevent that from happening, the only way Trump gets a deal that is permanent, that is worthy of a Nobel Prize, is if we build up the Ukrainian military during those 4 years to the point the Russians would never dare take them on. And so, we don't need the taxpayers to fund that. For example, Poland is buying billions and billions of dollars of U.S. weapons using foreign military financing loans, which we pay. They borrow the money from us to buy it. They pay interest on the loans and they pay them back. Ukraine is offered to do $50 billion in arms sales. Let's give them that. I think that would break the logjam and get a deal done, at least on the Ukrainian side.
Absolutely. So the other thing would be, I think the big lure that might get Democrats pushing back is say, listen, Putin, you stop this war now. And you stop this war now, we'll re-engage economically. We'll put you back on the SWIFT system. Those are some of the things we could use as levers. And if not, we're going to hit you with the X, Y, and Z sanctions. We have fully enforcing the European no longer get a special dispensation to buy your oil. We're going to start getting third parties, like India is starting to get sanctioned for buying your oil. I'm not sure if China would that too. And then we're going to make sure that Ukraine now has the money to actually buy their own weapons because of this because of the rare earth deal. So this is what's going to happen. Things are not going to stay the same if you walk away.
Exactly. I mean that's the peace deal in a nutshell. That's how you end this thing, and you force the Russians to the table. I guess what I don't understand is that the Ukrainians have said, like 44 days ago, Zelensky said, "I'm for a unilateral ceasefire, for an unconditional ceasefire," and Putin is refusing. At some point, there have to be some consequences for Putin. Putin is the obstacle to peace. What turned Trump on Zelensky was he sensed that Zelensky didn't want peace, and he's going to go after anybody he sees to be an obstacle to peace. Since the Oval Office meeting, Zelensky has been saying, we want peace. He's agreed to stop fighting while we negotiate a deal, and Putin's the one who continues to fight the war. At some point, Putin's going to have to either decide either I'm for peace or I'm against peace, and live with the consequences.
It's going to be interesting. And lastly, with the Iran talks, are they on the right track?
I don't know. Witkoff said, you know, well, our position is disarmament, but we could, you know, do reduced enrichment. You know, giving away the store before the negotiations talk. It's basically there's two options here. Either there has to be a.
I think he since amended that, by the way.
Yeah, he
got tougher.
That's a big mistake. Here's the options. A Libya-style deal in which the U.S. planes land in Tehran, load up all the enriched uranium, all the centrifuges, and take it back to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the way we did with the Libyan nuclear program, and then we don't bomb you, or we bomb the hell out of you, and we destroy it. Those should be the only options on the table for the Iranians, and anything short of either of those options is not good enough.
I saw what Fetterman put out last night. You know, basically, don't listen to them. They can't be trusted. Bomb them. I know it's simplistic, but I really don't after 40 years of going through these gymnastics and knowing what they've done to our men and women around the world, but especially in Iraq, I'm wondering how naive we have to be.
And they're weaker than they've ever been. They've lost all of their proxies. Trump is destroying the Houthis right now. Netanyahu has destroyed Hamas and Hezbollah. They've lost Assad. Israel has taken out their air defenses and taken out their ballistic missile capabilities. They're strategically naked right now. They won't be for long. They're going to rebuild their air defenses. They're going to rebuild their ballistic missile capability. But we have a moment of opportunity right now where they have maximum vulnerability, which means we need to put on maximum pressure and give them a deadline. You agree to a complete disarmament by date X, or we're taking it out.
Mark, I could talk to you for 2 hours and not cover everything. Thanks so much. There's nothing you can't handle. Have a great day.
And thanks for inviting me to bring your child to work day. I really would appreciate
it. Your kids are a little old. Thanks, Mark. 1-866-408-7669. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. This week, Jane Blasio joins me to discuss how she learned the sinister truth behind her adoption, as detailed in her memoir, Taken at Birth.
Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we're back. Just quick note. Last night on Laura Ingraham's show, you probably saw the full screen. I'm going to be out at, I'm going to be on June 21st. I'm going to be at Dayton, Ohio. WHIO listeners, hope to see you out there. History, Liberty, and Laughs. We bring news, information, patriotism, history to the stage, and it's fun. Same thing in August on the 23rd. I'm going to be in Dallas. And in Richmond, I have to see everyone there from our radio audience. And then, of course, in September, we're going to be in Richmond. So BrianKilmeade.com. I hope to see you in person and VIP opportunities. I get a chance to talk to you before the show. So much going on today. I think the president's going to have a few announcements. I think he knows and sees how the market reacts when he starts announcing the progress he's making. And the word is 19 deals are about to be done, framed out. And then you work out, look, it's got a huge trade staff. Then you work out the details. The restructuring has hurt his approval. It's going to be a time of uncertainty. I get it. But I think if you pass the big, beautiful bill, and then you start with these trade deals, and then you find out when is the right time to go head-to-head with China, you're talking about a boom.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think what has to happen is we need to make commitments to Ukraine that they're going to continue to get our intelligence, which they're doing, and continue to get military arms from the United States and from Europeans. That sends a loud message to Putin that we're not going away here. And we're going to continue to stay in this, stay in the negotiations, and continue to see this through till we actually have a peace deal.
And that is General Jack Keane talking about the talks in London, Ukraine, Russia, how sincere they are. You got to make the judge. I know that Secretary of State not being there, Witkoff not being there, sending a message. That might be part of the negotiation. Michael Rubin, Director of Policy Analysis of the Middle East Forum, also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, teaches classes on terrorism for the FBI, on security, politics, religion. and a history for U.S. and NATO military units, and joins us now. Michael, essentially, your resume says you've seen it and heard it all. Your take on the tactics in London.
You know, I'm not sure that this is a good deal. There's two issues here. One, is our goal simply to have the guns fall silent? If that's the case, then any deal works. But the danger is whether you're sacrificing long-term peace for the sake of short-term peace. If you're rewarding Putin for aggression, and then that could actually encourage more aggression. That's where the danger is right now, and that's why Ukraine and so many in Europe are upset.
So he's, the president says, look, you know, you're not going to get Crimea back. You're not going to get this this areas back. You've been deadlocked for a year. So just deal with the, in reality, this is how to stop the war. Just stop it here.
Well, what I'm reminded of, Brian, is when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, Margaret Thatcher said to George H.W. Bush, "Don't go wobbly on me now, George." The question is, when we look at the way Trump is approaching this, whether that would fit the definition of going wobbly. Back in 1990, there were a lot of people who said, look, Kuwait's not going to be independent again. We shouldn't worry about it. Colin Powell was first and foremost among them, but George H.W. Bush ultimately stepped up. And the question is, if Saddam Hussein had been rewarded with taking Kuwait, would he have gone further? That's the real danger, and that's why so many countries from the Baltic states to Kazakhstan are really worried, as are the Taiwanese, who might see the similar dynamics playing out. Hey, you're not going to get Taiwan back. It's Chinese anyway, so why don't we just accept it? That's the danger. That's the world we're moving into.
So the one thing I have to say, that for Russia to think this has been successful is a real stretch. When the doors close and the propagandists are not there, they have to be saying, what the hell did we do? They never in a million years, I don't think, thought they'd be struggling for 3+ years and be pulling people off the streets to join their military, begging North Koreans to help out and Yemenis to fight, wouldn't you say?
On some hand, yeah, but if anyone actually says that, they're going to end up falling out of a 10th-story window. That's also been the pattern in Russia itself. The way I look at this is Putin's been like a gambler who figures, if only I can play one more hand, then maybe I can recoup all my losses. And by this analogy, what it seems that the United States is prepared to do is actually affirm that belief and allow him to recoup his losses.
Here's what President Trump said yesterday, cut 10.
I think we have a deal with Russia. We have to get a deal with Zelensky, and I hope that Zelensky, I thought it might be easier to deal with Zelensky. So far, it's been harder, but that's okay. It's all right. But I think we have a deal with both.
So I'm firmly in the Zelensky camp. You know, I agree with the president on a lot, but the Ukraine are the good guys in this. And I think everything that we could give them to be successful is what I believe.
Well, I happen to share that belief. There's a pattern here, Brian, where Russia, because Putin has run the economy into the ground, tries to distract the Russian people with military action. He did it first in Georgia back in 2008. Then he did it with Crimea. Here's the thing. Once he's allowed to digest those territories, it actually costs Russia's economy more in order to integrate them. And that speeds up the process where he needs to distract the Russian people again. So if there's actually a reward, if he's given Eastern Ukraine, what's going to end up happening is Putin, in order to keep the Russian people distracted with that national flag, is actually going to have to speed up the cycle of conflict. That's where things get very dangerous.
So what tactically do you think is the benefit of Rubio and Witkoff not going to London or hanging out and hanging back?
Well, ultimately, that's the debate right now. But the issue is whether the United States is truly interested in the minutiae. Look, this would be a very positive tactic, and it would be a very positive tactic when it comes to other negotiations on Iran if it signals, hey, we're not going to do business as usual. We're not going to be dragged into an endless process. We're not going to allow you to treat diplomacy as an asymmetrical warfare strategy to tie our hands. Here's the deal. Take it or leave it. That's what I hope Trump is doing. Other people are questioning whether Rubio and Witkoff standing back is actually signaling a lack of interest. I actually don't think that's the case. I'm hoping that this is Trump negotiating in a very different way from his predecessors.
I do, too. And that's just it. I mean, you know how engaged Rubio is. You know how smart he is. And Witkoff's got great instincts, but I don't think he has great knowledge of the region. There's no indication is when Rubio's leading, I always feel better. It just, number one, he's Secretary of State. And number two, him and Waltz have the experience in the region. They took their time to know the names and know the battlefield and know the players. So anytime they're involved, I feel like we're better off. So not to put anything, not to put Witkoff down, I just don't know that he understands the depth of the area and the recent history with Vladimir Putin. And let's, if we can, let's jog over to Iran. We're now week three of talks. How do you think it's going?
You know, I think we're falling into Iran's trap of trying to tie us down so that they can have a fait accompli. This is what everyone has warned the Trump administration about moving in. Look, it's simple. Even, I mean, let's put aside the Joint Conference of Plan of Action. That wasn't actually a treaty. Iran is still beholden to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which it signed decades ago. There shouldn't be any ifs, ands, or buts about demanding its compliance. So the more we get trapped, the more we only see the trees and not the forest, the more Iran wins. That's why the Israelis and the Emiratis, the Saudis, are so worried about the Trump administration's direction right now.
So I've heard other people say, for example, that you know MBS, had one of his brothers go over to Iran, that they're not thrilled with us bombing over there. Even though they know Iran's the problem, they worry about what could happen after. What level do you think that they're hoping that Israel and the U.S. combine to take action?
You know, I think they're hoping. Put it this way, after Israel, a year ago April and also last October, demonstrated that they could hit Iran with surprise and precision, it actually assuaged a lot of concerns within the region. They are worried about stirring up the hornet's nest and not finishing the job. Look, Brian, when you have a hornet's nest, you have two good options. One is you leave it alone. The other is you get rid of it. The worst possible option is you stand underneath it, lightly tapping it with a stick. That's the major fear in the region. They want to be convinced that if action is going to be taken against Iran, it's going to be taken to fruition. What they're worried about are half steps.
So do you think that we have the munitions to, from what you know about their embedded nuclear program, to take it out?
Okay, here's the thing. The issue which is often exaggerated are those under-the-mountain facilities. That's not the biggest problem, because you don't have to destroy those facilities. You only have to destroy the entrances to those facilities. If Iranian nuclear scientists end up being entombed in them, not our problem. The issue, however, is Iran is so large. It's six times the size of the United Kingdom. And so you're not going to be able to fly in and out with surprise. That means you're going to have to take out enemy airfields, anti-aircraft batteries, command and control. And so back of the napkin calculation, that's around 1,300 sorties. Now, here's the thing, and this is the other dynamic that's coming into play. The supreme leader of Iran is 85 years old. He's about to turn 86. He's had cancer twice. He's partially paralyzed from an assassination attempt. There's going to be regime change in Iran simply because of the march of time. And so all these concerns about what comes next, that has nothing to do with military action. Military action might just speed that up by a week or two.
What do you think the people think of their government?
Oh, there's no doubt that the government has very little legitimacy among the people. That said, Iran's not a democracy. It's the guys with the guns that matter. And when it comes to the supreme leader supporters, you might have 25% of the youth who have grown up in this bubble. You can join the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps bubble when you're about 8 years old, because they run the equivalent of evil Boy Scout programs. And you can go to universities controlled by the Revolutionary Guard. And so sometimes when we hear this crazy rhetoric coming from people like the former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who also came from a military background in Iran, that reflects life inside the bubble. But most Iranians, they've moved on and they want nothing more than to join the wider world. Now, here's the thing. Zombie regimes like North Korea, like Iran, like others, have an ability to persist. They're not democracies. And so the question is, what happens as these zombie regimes continue.
That is, and what would happen the next day? And the other thing that people bring up is our troops are vulnerable in Syria and Iraq. Should they be worried? Or do you think we have a way to protect them?
And also, Brian, remember, we have our Fifth Fleet in Bahrain. Here's very quickly, here's what I would look for to show that military action is imminent. If we withdraw our aircraft carriers from the Persian Gulf, that's a sign that we're getting closer to military action, because if they're 400 miles outside in the northern Indian Ocean, we can strike at Iran, but they can't hit us with their speedboats, their drones, their sea mines, and so forth. That's, as an analyst, what I'm looking at now.
Lastly, the State Department is doing a restructuring. For the longest time, we always heard about the deep state was defined to the State Department. They do their own thing. They let the Secretaries of State come in. They almost dare them to change policies. A lot of their embassies seem to be almost anti-American, let alone the woke stuff that came in over the last 12 years, where we're sponsoring, you know, non-binary parades in Ecuador. So with the reform going on right now under the leadership of Secretary Rubio, are you comfortable with it?
I am comfortable with it. Look, I've talked to Secretary of State, both Republicans and Democrats, and here's the one thing they all have in common. No one trusts the State Department. Instead of relying on the State Department bureaucracy, they all have about 20 aides who they rely upon, and the State Department, they're just like hamsters going on their wheels. The fact of the matter is everyone acknowledges behind the scenes that the State Department is more geared to the 19th century than the 21st century. There's active debate about how you move on, but you're absolutely right. Without leadership, without constraining that deep state, without trimming that fat, we're going to be in a world of hurt in terms of our diplomacy.
But you are worried, and you write that you're worried about us pulling back in Africa. Why?
Well, what I'd say is that Africa is the real battleground for influence with Russia and China. It's where so many of the rare earths are and so forth. Frankly, it's much more important to have embassies in Africa right now than it is in Western Europe or in Canada, where we have consulates in Winnipeg and so forth. I mean, if we have, like so many other countries, a online presence for visas, for screening and so forth, we don't need to have all these very expensive embassies in places where they really do no good. I would say that having an embassy or consulate in Somaliland, which is right across from Yemen, would do more in a week than having an embassy in Slovenia would do for us over a decade.
You think Rubio understands that? Or you think he's getting his direction from other people?
I think Rubio understands that. But again, A, he's up against the deep state. And B, I'm not sure the Trump administration realizes how we need to engage in places like Africa and Asia. After all, we still don't have an assistant secretary for African affairs. That can't keep going if we hope to counter Chinese influence.
So the Congo president came and visited us and said, I got a deal for you. You can come and mine our rare earth. Just help us fend off these revolutionaries who want to overthrow the government. What is your thought on that?
Well, you know, Brian, I spent last August with those revolutionaries trying to overthrow the government. And before that, I spent time on the Congolese side. The fact of the matter is there isn't a country more corrupt than Congo right now. President Tshisekedi, the president of Congo, may sit on $24 trillion worth of minerals and rare earths and so forth, but I'm not sure that we could ever trust him to be our ally. He really is going down the Idi Amin path or the Saddam Hussein path. And basically, if we give him money, he's going to turn around the next day and say, hey, China, why don't you just give me a little bit more money and I'll rip up the agreements I just got from the Americans.
They did sign up for the Belt and Road Program, right?
I believe they did, yes.
Michael, unbelievable. Thanks so much for your firsthand unvarnished account. It's very consequential times. I look forward to talking to you again.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I'll squeeze in some calls. We're going to go over some movement on the trade situation. And what about this shouting match between Musk and Besant? Did it really happen? I'll explain.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we're back. So it happened and multiple people are talking about it. You know, Elon Musk is going to be leaving in a couple of weeks. Unrelated to the incident, I'll relate to you. But evidently, he's been clashing. He had clashes with Sean Duffy. I know that for a fact about what they're doing. He went in there very clinically and said, these people got to go and these people got to go. And Sean Duffy says, wait a second, I'm in transportation. Let me do that. He had a clash at a cabinet meeting with Marco Rubio, but they worked it out. And he's had multiple clashes with Scott Bessent. Remember, Scott was not a pick of Elon Musk. He keeps bringing up that Scott, who's a friend of the show, even before he was Treasury Secretary, I hope you remember, he worked for George Soros. But he split it on his own. He said the George Soros is funding these programs and doing what he's doing. It's not the guy I knew, whatever. But he went on his own, learned a lot from each other, did a lot of investing for him. And he impressed Trump. And he's done a fantastic job. But he wanted a different head of the IRS, and Musk put Gary Shapley in there, the whistleblower. And he went up to Trump and said, you got to get Gary Shapley out. I need a different guy in there with more experience. And the president went with Scott Bessent. And now Scott is clashing with Musk, and the shouting got so loud, you could hear it clearly into the Oval Office, and they were told to take it down the hall. And no one's denying it happened. I actually don't have a problem with it. I think it's noteworthy to notice, but it doesn't show a administration coming at the seams. It shows a lot of people who think they got the right way forward when it comes to finance, and there's one guy with the responsibility and more experience doing it, and I think it's Scott, and he has a real sense of the global economy, perhaps. I'm in awe of Elon Musk. I'm not saying that. I mean, I read so much about him, talked to so many people, but he's volatile, he's hot-headed, and Scott is just the opposite. Well, it's like Mnuchin, I think, perfect for that job. And I think Trump thinks so, too. And I think it's so important to point out that all these people told you, they're insiders, that Donald Trump, who gets so much money from Elon Musk, will do whatever Musk wants. They're inseparable, whatever. They're going to get each other's nerves. No. He listens to him. He really respects him. But Howard Lutnick's Commerce, not Treasury Secretary. Shapley's out of the IRS. And Scott Bessent has his ear when it comes to the economy. So Trump listens, but ultimately he's the decision maker.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. We're at 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, around the country, around the world, where I'll be able to walk back and forth to the train, they say, with not much problem when tourist season comes in about a month. They say a lot of people aren't coming to America. I like to see that for sure. I know Canadians are staying back. Good luck with that. Yeah, go see Vancouver. See how Quebec is this summer. Have at it. Eric Shawn at the bottom of the hour. He's got a great feature out on One Nation called Who Are the Houthis? So important. That's, we've been bombing them 18 of the last 20 days. They are shut down the Suez Canal. We have to open that back up. And standing by is Netanel Crisp. He's a Yale student senior who was prevented from walking across campus last night and harassed for the last 2 years because he is a Jewish student. And that is unacceptable. Why we let that go with the last administration is beyond me. So before we get to Netanel, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
There's a list of issues that we ask people what they felt about. The president is underwater in all but one, and that one is the border. So there's a lot of work to be completed, which if done successfully, I think would dramatically elevate his current approval rate.
No question. 100 days. Polls are in for Trump. They are not great, but he's fantastic on the border and on immigration. The tariff standoff and restructuring of trade was going to put us a little uneasy. But when you want to do big things, a lot of times you got to take the popularity hit. And for a president that's term limited out, it's the perfect time. Meanwhile, the next move is with China. I'll tell you what that could be.
Number two.
I think we have a deal with Russia. We have to get a deal with Zelensky. And I hope that Zelensky, I thought it might be easier to deal with Zelensky. So far, it's been harder, but that's okay. It's all right.
Emotions rage in London. Ukraine and Russia inch closer to a ceasefire as the bombing continues. Thanks to Russia in Kyiv. And oddly, but it's probably a reason behind it, Secretary of State Rubio and Steve Witkoff boycott the London talks.
Number one.
You know, I was supposed to be doing my senior thesis last night and instead was faced by a mob that wouldn't let me walk through my own campus. But unfortunately, not something new for myself or my Jewish peers at Yale.
Netanyahu, that was him speaking just there. This has to stop. Ivy institutions erupt with anti-Semitic protests. Now Yale has moved to be to take immediate action against the group that caused so much disruption. But I got a huge problem. Number one, that they let this exist. And number two is that the group flat out lied. They said their club charter has been revoked and that they didn't plan anything on Wednesday when the Israeli official came to speak. And they lied because we have this thing called social media now. Netanyahu Crisp, a senior at Yale, joins us now on Zoom. Hey, thanks for joining me last night with Laura, and thanks so much for joining me today. First off, you got the video. Someone shot the video of you just trying to walk across campus. How long have you been dealing with this anti-Semitic hatred?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me again. It's been 2 years. You know, I'm a senior here at Yale, a Jewish senior, and starting day one, October 7th, we started facing this kind of hate. 2 days later, on October 9th, hundreds of students organized by this exact same student group, including many members of the Yale faculty, gathered right off campus to celebrate the resistance's success.
No way. Whoa. Stop that. Faculty? Celebrating
faculty
with them
involved,
off
yes,
campus
sir.
Or on campus?
This was immediately off campus, but these same faculty members then continued with these demonstrations on campus throughout the last 2 years. And we've seen throughout even recent days a continued kind of surgence of this anti-Israel, anti-Semitic activity motivated and perpetrated by members of the staff, of administration, and of students.
I assume that you didn't know any of this when you picked Yale. I mean, I can't imagine how great your grades must have been to get in. I'm sure you had a lot of choices. If you knew anything about the anti-Semitism on campus, would you have made this choice?
You know, it's hard to say. I'm definitely a fighter, so I'm very glad to be able to be here and to support my Jewish peers. And that, I think, is what's motivated me to stay and to stick around and to keep the fight going. But no, when I applied to Yale, I viewed it as a home. When I came to Yale, it was a home away from home. And now it feels much more like an asylum. And the patients are running the show. So it's a crazy scene and definitely not what I expected.
So Netanyahu, are these American kids? Are they foreign students? What's the makeup of the Yalies for Palestine group?
Definitely a diverse combination. We have students from the graduate schools involved, from the undergraduates, a variety of different groups that will merge for these events, also bringing in outside agitators, as we observed with this demonstration on Tuesday night, where it definitely appeared there were a lot of adults who had come in from the surrounding areas, locations unknown. So a wide range of students, many of whom, though, are using both the liberties that exist as U.S. citizens, but also these liberties that are provided to them on the basis of being students on visas, and they are taking advantage of that and trampling over American values in the process.
Let me ask something. I mean, the President of the United States wants to look into who these foreign students are. You know, why are they taking spots away from Americans? I know you have to have foreign students. I'm not dumb. You need people paying full freight. But I don't think the kid in Indiana or in Portland, Oregon, has got to lose his or her spot after doing just to be eligible for Ivies to some kid who's going to come here and create unrest on campus or doesn't really have the grades to get in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm a descendant of a proud immigrants on one side of my family, a Mayflower descendant on the other. So I really embody the American dream, having seen kind of and received and been the recipient really of the great work and hard work that my ancestors had to do to allow me to be where I am today. And to put all of this in perspective and context, just acknowledging where these demonstrations are happening, you know, while I'm being blocked and while my Jewish peers are being blocked from walking through our campus, we're looking up and seeing the American flag. This event was being hosted on sacred ground. This is the area that houses Yale's Memorial for Veterans. With the American flag there having been torn down at last year's encampment and these students having attempted to burn it, having only barely been saved by some of my friends. So this is the area that they are desecrating in the process. And as that flag waves, I watch as all of these values that my ancestors, my great-grandfather who served in World War II, fought so hard to preserve.
So you're saying a year
trampled on.
Wow. So you said a year ago they took down your flag. They took down the flag and they were going to burn it. And you helped stop that?
My friends did. I'm very grateful. Yes.
So the let's just go back to the incident. Why were they protesting on Wednesday?
Great question. You know, they give a variety of different reasons, but the main thing is it was the 1 year anniversary of last year's encampment. These students don't need an excuse to be anti-Semitic. They look for any opportunity that they can. It combined with a variety of different events. First and foremost, this is during Yale's Bulldog Days, which is a period of time for 3 days when over 1,400 early accepted students or students that had recently been accepted into the class of 2029 arrived on campus to experience Yale for 3 days. And that's what they were met with. So I watched as this event was happening, as incoming first year students, Jewish students, were witnessing their first kind of incidents of anti-Semitism. And this also coincided with Yom HaShoah, which is Israel's Holocaust Memorial Day. So for both of those events to be taking place at the same time just reflects the degree of hostility that Jews are facing here at Yale.
So I understand there was a visit from Israel's national security minister. Was that true? Is that part of the reason they came out?
Potentially. They did a second demonstration yesterday. That was an off-campus event that was housed separately, which there was numerous demonstrations for as well. So we saw kind of this combination of all those factors, and that was an attempt by them to shut down that event. They targeted Jewish students and participants who were trying to attend and to leave. I know people who had water bottles thrown at their head there by these protesters. So we just continue to see this violence go unchecked.
So Netanel, what is the attraction to the Muslim extremist culture? If I said this after 9/11, you would know, you're too young. It would have been crazy. There was an overexuberance and of anger towards the Muslim community, and that needed to be stopped. I get it. But if they were protesting Muslims, stopping them from moving across campus, if they were stopping black men, students or white students, black students from going across campus, there would be outrage. But for some reason, we have to go after a school for allowing anti-Semitism. Do you agree with my analogy? Why they have a problem with some and willing to accept other types of bigotry?
Absolutely. That's something that, you know, I've highlighted in my Title VI complaint through the Department of Ed, which I've worked with my Jewish peers here at Yale to file, which is highlighting this disparate treatment, that this doesn't happen to other groups, any other protected groups. This only happens to Jews. It's only the Jewish question that you have to analyze whether or not this is anti-Semitism, whereas in any other case, the school over the last 2 years would have come out unequivocally in condemning these types of actions.
So they stopped Columbia. They froze $400 million of Columbia. And Columbia says, okay, what do I need to get that back? And they're going to try to do everything except for they will not agree to any access to their curriculum. And then we know what's happening with Harvard. They got their money frozen. They're suing to get the grants back. What would get Yale's attention?
I think we need to see similar action. I think we need to have some funding pulled. There has to be immense pressure placed on the Yale administration by the federal government and by alumni and anybody else who can. And I think you highlighted a key point, which is the departments. This really is an issue that lies in the faculty here at Yale in large part. There's fantastic faculty here at Yale and some really bad ones. And I think looking at specific departments, whether it's American Studies or East Asian Studies that have been hosting these events on and off.
So I can imagine what American Studies are like. Should they be anti-American Studies?
Right. It's that would be a better way of putting it. The majority of those faculty have engaged in these activities and are perpetuating this type of anti-American sentiment amongst the student body.
Have you noticed that in classes you've taken? What's your major?
I'm a history major.
So wow. In terms of classes, history, how do they characterize American history?
It varies. I'm very selective as to which professors I'll take courses with, because unfortunately I've found that the bar has been lowered and that many of these newer faculty are just people that I don't feel safe being at the mercy of for grading or otherwise in the classroom.
So I want you to hear what Alan Garber said. He's the president of Harvard. And when asked about what funding cuts would mean for research, let's look. This is cut 7.
What's a risk is the excellence of higher education in the United States, and in particular, the research mission of many of our universities, which play such a vital role in the U.S. economy and in the health and well-being of the American people.
Is that a risk if we cut the funding and freeze the grants?
You know, I think there are definitely losses that are going to occur, but at the end of the day, these schools are not entitled to taxpayer dollars to fuel this anti-Semitic hate that's overwhelmed these campuses. And they can continue that, but not at the taxpayer's expense. So I think the federal government has every right to cut this funding. And that if the schools want to react and respond, the way to do that is to fight back against this discrimination, to look over kind of their teaching habits and styles and curriculum, and finding a way to bring them back to kind of the highlight of a elite education here in the United States.
Has anyone reached out to you in the faculty? Has anyone reached out to you with the Yale administration?
I've not been contacted by the head execs here at Yale. I've yet to hear anything from the president, and that's something that I'm still waiting to see.
Does it hearten you that the Yalies for Palestine have had their charter revoked as a club on campus?
Definitely a step in the right direction, but unfortunately, perhaps a little too late. It's been 2 years of this. And I think to highlight just how important that is, for the last 2 years, this student group was receiving funding from Yale to engage in these anti-Semitic protests. So that not only were they violating all of Yale's policies in the process, but also violating the law, and Yale was giving them the money to do so. So I'm glad that's no longer the case, but I expect that little will change in terms of their activities. And they've even put out, you know, social media posts today highlighting that this will not in any way deter them from these actions. So until Yale takes the necessary measures necessary steps to penalize and discipline these students, to expel those students responsible and ensure that they don't receive their degrees, we will not see the change that we really need to.
Well, he's a fighter, and we see it on video. You don't see it in this segment, but you saw it. It's out there online of Netanel just trying to get across campus, get ready for a senior thesis, and he gets stopped. Why? Because he's Jewish. I mean, can you believe I'm talking about this in 2025? That's what he's living as a senior at Yale, and he's felt it for the last 2 years. Let's stay in touch, and we'll continue to push back. And I think people should know what the Trump administration is fighting for. It's for people like you. And to do the right thing. No, thanks so much. Stay safe.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Yeah, we are back. I'm just astounded. I could have went for another half hour. I'm just astounded that someone at Yale, and let's say, you know, you get some scholarship, but let's say you don't. $77,000 to go to Yale. You study there for 4 years, a prestigious degree, but yet for the last 2 years, you're watching people protest your religion. You're watching people being fomented and catalyzed by the faculty to do this. Do you hear what he said? The faculty was in the middle of all this. If I am the president of that university and the faculty is part of anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic behavior, you're gone the next day. Get your union to sue if there's college union professors, whatever, gone. But instead, they're worried about being discovered. They're not worried about the problem. I think that you should expect Linda McMahon, President Trump, to say, Yale, you're going to get slammed. Because anybody who watched the interview last night I did with Laura or listened just now and watched on Zoom on this show, this is a problem at Yale as much as Harvard and maybe not as much as Columbia. Columbia is the worst. And they got Barnard. It's a mess. But this is a huge issue. And they seem to want to suppress it. They don't seem to want to fix it. And taking away their charter. And just remember, I just said to him, Yale's for Palestine has had their charter taken away. They can't be a club on campus anymore. He said, well, that's a good first step. But they were funding it prior to this. Why would you fund Yalies for Palestine? There is no Palestine, number one. You mean for Gaza? Gaza Strip? Okay. It should be Yalies for the Gaza Strip because they're run by Hamas. So to me, if you're going to run that organization, my follow-up question is, you realize Hamas runs Palestinian territories. Are you for Hamas? Because they're for wiping out every Jew, and we are not for that at Yale. I would wonder, why is there another, maybe a Middle East class where you want to debate this? Do You want to have a guest speaker on from Gaza? Sure. I don't care. Everybody. But you have an Israeli official coming up there, and then you decide to block the campus, and you see some of these kids. Look online to these videos. These are 21-year-old white kids standing up, wearing their Yasser Arafat kofas or kifas, dressing up as if they understand that community, that culture, that they want any part of it, where women don't exist, they can't get jobs, they're third-class citizens, a lot of which are the ultra-Orthodox and behind closed doors in burqas. Do you realize the life of a woman, yet you're sitting there protesting for those people at Yale in America? Go live there for a while. You know, I hope we can get Douglas Murray back, because he did spend a lot of time there recently. And he, like me, and maybe you, are appalled about what the side we're always seem to be taking here in America, the wrong side.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Eric Schoen's going to be joining me shortly. If you notice, everyone's focused on the Signal chat and who is on that line and Peter Goldberg from The Atlantic and all those things. But what I think is most important is what they were doing on that chat. They were bombing the Houthi rebels. And why is that important? Because we've been hitting structures and launchers, but we were not hitting the group itself, which has just run rampant in Yemen, taking control of the region, combined with getting intelligence from mostly financing from Iran and intelligence and support and missiles from Russia and China. They've been a real problem in that area. And they're the least controllable, we understand, out of Hezbollah and Hamas. People don't know anything about them. They said, who are these guys in Moxigan causing so much trouble in the region? Well, Eric Schoen has got a brand new special. It is out on Fox Nation now. Who are the Houthis? And here's when you download it, this is a little of what you can expect.
The Houthis are not your father's terrorists.
They're becoming more powerful.
They are deadly, they are lethal, and they hate us.
Much of the world underestimated the Houthis.
The civil war in Yemen continues to escalate while foreigners flee.
U.S. warships came under attack by over a dozen ballistic and cruise missiles and drones fired by the Houthis.
The world was stunned.
Allah! Akbar!
Iran found a group with a grievance willing to turn their guns on people.
They want to kill as many Americans as they possibly can.
So that is Eric Schoen, and that's the question, Eric. Who are the Houthi rebels?
Hey, Brian, how are you? You know,
great to see you. It's
their name, Houthis. I mean, like, what?
Is that a name after a guy?
Yes, it is. It's Hussein al-Houthi. He founded the group. I think people, like, if you said it was like al-Qaeda or the Taliban or the Gambino crime family, you'd know who they are. But this weird name, and it's not connected to Yemen, but that's where they live.
But they'd like to take over Yemen, right?
Yes, yes, they did. They helped topple the president a number of years ago, and they've taken over much of the country. And they have been lobbing ballistic missiles at us, at our U.S. Navy assets. And what makes them so lethal, actually, I think, beyond al-Qaeda and the Taliban now, is you have a small strait in the Red Sea called the Bab el-Mandab. One quarter of all global transportation, cargo, ships, oil goes through that little strait. And they've been firing ballistic missiles at these tankers and at these cargo ships, and that has strangled global trade. That's why they're so dangerous, and President Trump is taking action.
So how do they go from rebels to this fighting force that has gotten a lot of momentum?
Well, you said it, Iran. That's why, because they have been funded by Iran. They've taken over a lot of the artillery and the military assets that they captured from the Yemenis government. So they have a tremendous amount, a stockpile of an arsenal, and they have not only attacked Israel, but they've also attacked Saudi Arabia, and they've been attacking us. Their slogans are death to America, death to Israel, a curse upon the Jews, victory to Islam.
So why would Joe Biden, knowing everything you just said, take them off the terror watch list when he becomes president?
Amazing. Great question. Absolutely right. Unbelievable. I mean, really, I think there was a point where the Biden administration thought that, well, for humanitarian efforts, we need to help the people of Yemen, take them off the list. It's all that carrot, but there's no stick.
You know what the carrot was for? Iran.
Exactly.
Like, hey, if we want to go into missile talks, now that Donald Trump is gone, we're going to show you we were sincere by your buddies. We're going to take them off the terror watch list. Maybe give them some aid. But who were they bombing? Saudi Arabia. And who was the outlaw pariah nation in Joe Biden's mind? Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that, absolutely right. Total huge mistake. President Trump had put them on the terror watch list in the first administration. The minute he got back into office, they're back on the terror watch list. And even more, he said he's going to bomb the hell out of them. And he's doing that. Joe Biden didn't do that. A lot of our warships sat in the Red Sea just taking it. They would just lob, the Houthis would just lob these missiles
and we're knocking
at us.
Rockets,
and that's what we're doing. Yeah, we're knocking rockets down. Dozens and dozens.
Costing us a lot of money.
Dozens and dozens, and not really hitting back. Hitting back occasionally, yes, at some of the spots where they were launched from. But President Trump is bombarding them with massive bombing raids, took out the whole port to deny them oil. This is how you do it. And you send a message to Tehran, we're not fooling around. You've got to stop this. We're going to militarily destroy the Houthis. And that is what President Trump, to his credit, is doing now.
Right. So here's a little more. You heard the promo. Here's more. This is the Houthis and what they're about. Cut 42.
The Houthis don't hide what they believe. And their slogan is death to America, death to Israel, curse upon the Jews, and victory to Islam. So certainly this group isn't trying to hide its intentions or its allegiances.
They want to kill as many Americans as they possibly can, as well as wipe out Israel.
The Houthis abscond with humanitarian aid. They literally engage in slavery. They fire projectiles on population centers.
They also enlist child soldiers, the Houthis. I mean, they are beyond deplorable.
So, and they every time they're able to hold us off or strike a ship, they look more, that becomes more attractive for them to get more recruits.
Yeah, right? And you know what they're doing that the other groups aren't? Social media. They got TikTok. People around the world, all these kids. Remember the commando raid? They launched a Hollywood-style Arnold Schwarzenegger, James Bond commando raid with the helicopter on a ship. And they videoed the whole thing.
Whose ship?
And it was called the Israeli-owned, American-owned, Israeli-owned global venture ship that they took, and then they put it in port. They held the crew kidnapped for about a year and a half, and then they made it a tourist attraction in Yemen. But so people actually came to the ship to take pictures. But the big thing is they put their raid on social media, so they're very sophisticated when it comes to publicity. And mm-hmm. So people download this all around the world, and all these young people say, boy, isn't this cool? Look at what they're doing. So we've really got to fight back.
Secretary Hegseth's been all over them. Everyone focuses on the signal chat, but what was happening? They're taking real shots at now the leaders there. And they must have somebody on the ground because there was some fear that our intelligence would be compromised by the detail on which was revealed, right?
President Trump had a great line the other day when he was asked about Secretary Hegseth's troubles. He goes, how's he doing? He goes, ask the Houthis. That's the bottom line.
That also helps get viewers, right? I mean, Eric, you got a special out for a reason. Here's more of how everybody underestimated this what everyone thought was like a rudimentary tribe. Cut 43.
Much of the world underestimated the Houthis. This is a very rugged group. The looking down on this actor as a ragtag fighting force is a mistake by anyone.
Houthi rebels.
Iranian-backed Houthi rebels.
Iran-backed Houthis.
The Houthis may be new on America's radar, but their battle is centuries old.
And that is that battle. They're Shia, right?
Yep. They're Shia, but they're also a something called Zaydi, but Islam. But that's under Shia, and that of course is connected with Iran. So they're a complete sponsor of Iran. They're a complete proxy of Iran, and that's one reason why basically we have to try to take them out as best as possible.
You know what I remember? You know, 60 Minutes is getting all this publicity now, Eric, Sean, about their leader walking away, their executive producer, because he can't do the things he wants. I remember them doing a big feature on Saudi Arabia, how mean they were to Yemen and the Houthi rebels because they were blockading them. Why were they blockading them? Because they were being rocketed on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So they said, listen, what are we dealing with this? Let's just lock this group out. They were missing the big picture, but that played into Joe Biden coming and going, these guys are bad. Houthis are potentially good.
Some of the, as I said, carrots that have been given to the Iranian regime under President Biden and under President Obama are just unbelievable. You cannot really legitimately negotiate with another party that wants to lie, cheat, and steal. And that's been the history of the Iranians throughout the whole history of this. And President Trump, by putting the battle group, this is what I love. It's good cop, bad cop. He takes a battle group, two battle groups of aircraft carriers, puts them within striking distance. You've got Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, saying, attack him, attack him. Now President Trump's the good guy. He's saying, no, we're not going to do that. That is how you make a deal. President Trump, in my view, because I've covered him for like 40 years as a real estate developer, he knows deals and he knows leverage. And that's what he's doing now. And by attacking the Houthis, he's putting leverage on Tehran by putting the two aircraft carrier striker groups within distance and threatening a potential attack against the nuclear facilities. He's putting the sledgehammer on Iran to try and get a legitimate deal, and the Houthis destroying their military capability is all part of
that.
But
if you just look at the whole region, Eric, as you know, who finances Hamas? Predominantly Iran. Who they are like-minded with more? Hezbollah. That's Iran. Who's financing the Houthi rebels? Iran. Who's providing drones to Russia to bomb Ukraine? It's Iran. Who got a huge loss and was propping up Assad? Iran. But it still didn't keep Assad in power. So between them losing their missile defense, between losing Assad, between Hezbollah being brought to its knees and Hamas on its back, this nemesis of America for the last 40 years has never been more vulnerable. It's hard to imagine a scenario where people who are serious about bringing some type of order to the Middle East don't take advantage of this.
And let me go even further than that. Who wants to assassinate and has tried to assassinate people here in our country, on our soil? Iran. They tried to bomb a Cafe Milano, which is a very well-known high-end restaurant in Georgetown in Washington, D.C.
Tried to kill a reporter over in Staten Island.
Wanted to kill, yes, in Brooklyn, Masih Alimlejad, who's a militant, not a militant, but, you know, a very activist. That's the word. She's a really anti-regime activist. Just a few weeks ago, there were some alleged agents who were convicted for trying to kidnap and kill her and take her back to Tehran.
So I have not seen much video besides of the attacks. I know we've been bombing maybe 18 of the last 22 days.
Yeah.
Have you seen substantial damage done? Because I've been reading some features saying that the Houthi rebels, it's very hard to penetrate them. They are very well hidden. They hide their munitions well.
That is true. And they can move the ballistic missile launching sites because they're mobile. But the President Trump has taken this a step further by ratcheting it up, taking out the oil depot, the oil facilities in the port. So when you start striking the infrastructure that supports all that, if you can't get oil, and if you can't get your facilities, that is one way to try and decapitate them. And that's what the military and Secretary of Defense Hegseth, they're trying to do right now.
Right. And lastly, this is a last cut from your feature about who are the Houthi rebels and who are the Houthis. Cut 41.
After the U.S. toppled Saddam Hussein, Hussein al-Houthi tried to capitalize on the chaos.
Hussein al-Houthi led a rebellion against the Yemeni government. And on September 10th, 2004, he and 20 aides were assassinated by the Yemeni government.
Well, you know, good news, bad news. The martyr for them.
And his death actually vitalized the organization. Hussein al-Houthi became the symbol of resistance against any Western power.
And that's when 2004, see the first Houthi rebellion.
And that's when it started.
Yeah.
And we were very cognizant of that because we were trying to battle al-Shabaab in the area. Mm-hmm. There was obviously ISIS rose up, and then you got al-Qaeda. And then I thought, in Yemen, we have a friendly government, but they do have a terror problem there.
Yeah.
And then we kind of got our eye off the ball and focused more on ISIS and Iraq and the comeback in Syria. But at the same time, they've been growing.
Yeah, they have been. And all with the background of trying to make nicey-nice with Tehran, which doesn't work.
Never has. Eric Schoen, we'll look forward to getting another reason to get Fox Nation. Who are the Houthis? Get some competence, because where is Trump going this? Where is Trump's delegation going this weekend to Oman to negotiate with Iran? And if you want to get leverage, you blow up one of their affiliates. And that's what we're doing. Eric, thanks so much.
Hey, Brian, thank you.
Back in a moment.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
China, in particular, is in need of a rebalancing. Recent data shows the Chinese economy tilting even further away from consumption toward manufacturing. China's economic system, with growth driven by manufacturing exports, will continue to create even more serious imbalances with its trading partners.
So that was the Treasury Secretary really taking the lead on all these trade deals. Today, they're meeting with Norway, and shouldn't be a problem. They put like $2 trillion into mostly our stock market. They got great stocks, fantastic partner now in NATO. But the real talk about China. So what is the deal? Now, Trump indicated yesterday that maybe there might be some give on these sides. Right now, we're at a 145% tariff. He says, we're not going to stay that high. We're going to get it lower. Maybe I'll lower it now. But as I look at the world press, China thinks they're winning by when the president comes out and he says, you know, maybe we'll back off a little. Maybe we won't. And, you know, China's going to come to the table. We're going to do a good deal. They look at that as, well, we're winning. I know Trump. You know Trump. Everybody here, enemies and allies, know Trump. That's how he feels at the moment. He's working the refs, working the press, taking questions. He didn't walk out with a speech and say, let me tell you what we're doing with the trade right now and tariffs. So what he's doing is he's affecting the market positively. It's up 231 points today. It'll be the third straight day that it's up. He says, I'm not going to fire Jay Powell. The market's up. Yeah, we'll work out a deal with China. The market's up. We've got 18 deals ready to go. The market goes up. India, the biggest economy that we're dealing with now, market goes up. And we have positive moves with Japan, too. So we could have something in the next few weeks. It's an encouraging statement. But China is looking at the fact that Trump is not speaking as tough as weakness. And they are ramping up, get this, business charm offensive towards Taiwan. Really? While you're doing mock invasions, you also want to do business and keep us away. Now, they warned our allies, don't do a deal with Trump. They're doing deals with Trump. We, according to the Wall Street Journal, warned them. We're talking to our allies saying, you know, don't be good with China. What's going to bother Trump, and he's been warned by CEOs of major companies, big box stores, is bare shelves or light shelves. And when people stop seeing things in their stores, they're going to go, uh-oh, we got to look out for this. See? Something to think about. Trump's got to stay ahead of it. So he's right now reciprocal tariffs for 15%, 90-day pause, but we are getting money in from all trade of things coming in. One by one, we're cutting new deals. Now, how are those deals cut? Other experts have said when you cut a deal, it takes like 45 weeks to actually finish out the details of a deal. I was laughed at last night by Kevin Hassett when I said it. Why? Because he says, no, we're not talking about an intricate NAFTA agreement. We're talking about a trade relationship. And also, I look at the polls, and people think that the Fox polls are bad. Now, if you look at pure numbers, people say, well, Trump's got to be upset 100 days in. His approval's at 44%. When it comes to the economy, it's not strong. There's very few people who think the tariffs are working. But I think when you try to do major things that affect people's lives, a lot of times not popular. When you came in with supply side and economics with Ronald Reagan and David Stockman just resigned and said, I don't believe in this, immediately inflation went up and people thought this actor doesn't know what he's doing, but he had a big picture in mind, and we know it worked. Border security, the president's got 55% approval. Foreign policy, 40%. Economy, 38%. Tariffs, 33%. Inflation, 33%. Overall, 44%. If the trade starts coming in, inflation starts, by the way, it's going in the right direction. You get the tariffs, become deals. Border security is already through the roof, and then the big, beautiful bill is on the cusp, probably something in June. Things will change rapidly.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, thanks so much for being here. Brian Kilmeade Show, moving through. And don't forget, we got our One Nation show Sunday at 10 p.m. And we have Sunday at 10 on Fox News Channel. And I got the live shows on stage. I'll be in Dayton, Ohio in June. I'll be in Richmond, Virginia in September, and I'll be in Texas, huge venue, over in Dallas. So go to BrianKilmeade.com, History, Liberty, and Laughs. We put together a show. It's not just, hey, this is me, here's what I think. You get that on radio. This is a show. I was able to use my 7 history books, 2 sports books, and I think do something kind of unique. Bottom of the hour, Adam Hunter, fresh off his appearance on Gutfeld last night, as funny, as insightful as it gets, and he plays off the news, which is perfect. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
There's a list of issues that we asked people what they felt about. The president is underwater in all but one, and that one is the border. So there's a lot of work to be completed, which, if done successfully, I think would dramatically elevate his current approval rating.
That is Britt Hume. 100 days, polls are in for a Trump team. They're not fantastic except for immigration, but why I don't think the Trump team is worried and why I don't think they are worried.
Number two.
I think we have a deal with Russia. We have to get a deal with Zelensky, and I hope that Zelensky, I thought it might be easier to deal with Zelensky. So far, it's been harder, but that's okay. It's all right.
Here we go. Emotions rage in London as Ukraine and Russia inch closer to a ceasefire. But Russia bombed Kyiv, killing 9. Trump condemned them. And he has some friction with Zelensky. And it looks like Rubio and Witkoff are boycotting the talks. Why I think that's part of a tactic, it's not part of a frustration.
Number one.
You know, I was supposed to be doing my senior thesis last night and instead was faced by a mob that wouldn't let me walk through my own campus. But unfortunately, not something new for myself or my Jewish peers at Yale.
That is a Yale senior, Jewish student, who just wanted to get to the library and cross campus, but was stopped by anti-Semitic, pro-Palestinian sanctioned clubs at Yale who are against Jews on campus. Why is that okay? You know the answer. It is not. Have they done enough to push back? They pretend to, but this has been going on for years and have not been effective in taking this down. Education needs to be addressed at every level. And while the administration says they want to put our hands off and give it to the states, they're still moving forward. And then with education reform, here's Linda McMahon yesterday. There's a series of executive orders. When it comes to higher education, they're looking at accreditation, making it a lot harder to get. Here's Linda McMahon on the civil rights and the First Amendment and how they mix. Cut one.
The president ran on anti-Semitism on campuses. He said he wasn't going to stand for it. We saw what happened at Columbia. I mean, you cannot have students locking up other students in libraries and beating on glass windows and saying death to Israel and death to USA. And this has been tried to be portrayed as, you know, a First Amendment right. And that is absolutely not what this is about. This is a civil rights issue.
It is a civil rights issue. Like, let me go to class. I'm paying $72,000. Who the hell are you to tell me you don't like my religion or you don't like Israel? And now you love the Palestinian people. Go to Gaza. I think the West Bank has affordable rentals. See how that's going to go. You could answer to Hamas. And by the way, anyone who comes out and says, I'm pro-Palestinian, just know that the Hamas is running it. You have to show me that you're not pro-terrorist because that's what they are. So I was stunned to know that Yale or anybody, Brown, Princeton, all these Ivy League schools would show anti-Semitic behavior, knowing that hundreds of millions, if not billions, were at risk. Because you can know that this administration won't take anything about that. You know they're taking action. You know that Harvard's suing them. You know that Columbia has basically agreed to do the things to get $400 million unfrozen, but have not heard back. But this is the Yale student, had joined us on this show in a different hour, but joined me last night with Laura Ingraham, Cut 3.
We need your help. We would appreciate it. We would love it. You know, Shalom Yale should be next. So Jewish students are facing this too often. Yale has clearly not gotten the message and continues to allow these things to happen. And they need to be reminded. So come to Yale.
So the Yale president said this. Yale is for Palestine, that's the name of the group, Tuesday, that it was not responsible for the protests, which began around 8 o'clock and dispersed before 11:30. However, in a university press release Wednesday afternoon, the university cited social media posts the group made calling for people to join them in the event and a public statement alleging to take credit. So in the announcement, Yale acknowledged that the gathering was not affiliated with the Yalies for Palestine or any other student organization. So they are liars and they're stupid. I thought Yaleys and Ivy League people are smart. even if you didn't agree with them. But these idiots are denying it's them, but yet taking credit for the unrest and bragging that they stopped Jews from going across campus. In one Instagram post, Yale's for Palestine caption read, a video of the protest with all cap words saying, repost, share, join the students. But they told the president it wasn't them. So they revoked their charter. So they, Yale revoked the club status for the group Yalies for Palestine. If you came to me and you said, Brian, you're president of a college, these group want to see, I'll go send them in. What would you like to do? I would like to form a group for Palestinians. Are you Palestinian? Nope. Well, why are you doing this? Well, I feel bad for them. Okay, what are you feeling bad about? They walked away from the Oslo deal. They walked away in the 1940s. They could have had half of Israel, but they weren't part of it. Well, is this in an homage to Yasser Arafat? Are you pro-Hamas? Are you miss Sinwar? What's the reason for it? I mean, any group that's run by a terrorist organization needs to be questioned. Not that you're Palestinian. I don't care. That's your heritage. I have nothing to do with you. You feel bad for the people. I understand that. So it's a foundation. So you're going to raise money for a foundation? No. We're going to protest. What are you going to protest? Well, I'm going to protest against Israel. Really? Because Israel's an ally of ours, and they're a democracy. What are you protesting against? Well, we want to protest. What? You want Sharia law? Like, what are you looking to do? You're looking to raise money for the Palestinian people? I get it. You're looking to go against the democracy in the region? I need to understand it. Oh, you have faculty with you. I mean, we had this student on who said that faculty is right in the middle of this at Yale. So they saw protesters, and I see the video. They pitched a number of tents to celebrate 1 year since they had a number of tents and encampments that stopped all class. Harmeet Dillon, the Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, reposted on X about Netanel Crisp, the 26-year-old who I interviewed, which said that Jewish students were blocking him from going across campus, and they were. The video doesn't lie. They do. And yes, he's obviously wanted people at home and me and you to see it. So he had somebody shoot it, and you see these cowards in masks, white kids, sitting there. And the foreign students play a critical role in this, which is why I love the fact that the Trump team is looking at your foreign students' admissions and the criteria involved. Is it just people from the Middle East that write big checks? Do you have any proof that these kids are even good students? So I'll talk about that. With all this going on campus, there's a story now in the New York Times that says the Jewish Democrats in Congress want an explanation about what Trump's doing. Really? How about a pat on the back for doing what Joe Biden didn't do, what Chuck Schumer refused to do as a Jewish American, and that's standing up for Jewish students? You need to know and demand to know what President Trump is up to. How about trying to fix the problem you left for him that we didn't think existed in this country, or I naively did? So the other thing is, you see a big, when it comes to education, here's what the Democrats have been saying about what the Trump is doing on his strength. I mean, if you look at the polls, 56% of the country, 89% of Republicans, most of the country sees what he did in the border, cracking down on criminals in their midst, empowering ICE to get illegals out of our country. You say that most Americans want every illegal thrown out. We're not even saying that. Even Trump didn't even say that. Tom Homan doesn't say that. So instead of saying, well, Trump's doing a good job at the border and Joe Biden let us down, but I got a problem with Trump on tariffs. I got a problem with, Trump's getting rid of the DEI, whatever you stand for. But instead, you want to know why these guys and these women, these protesters on campus, have been brought back and put in ICE facilities on the cusp of being deported. So these Democrats are either going overseas to visit illegals sent home in prison, like El Salvador, we're going to ICE facilities in Louisiana. So listen to what Ayanna Pressley, an embarrassing squad member, Senator Ed Markey, and Congressman Jim McGovern yesterday, Cup 5.
Mahmoud Khalil has not been convicted of any crime. He was simply exercising his right to free speech. This is a hostile White House in the midst of an active, hostile government takeover. They are godless and lawless.
We were told that this is a torture place and not a detention place by people inside of the facility.
I don't know what the hell has happened to Marco Rubio. He's essentially become not Secretary of State, but a thug. This is how thugs behave.
I can't wait to get Rubio on to have him respond to that. You idiot. he doesn't think international students should be causing unrest and harassing Jewish students and demanding divestiture from Israel by other institutions that were kind enough to admit you into it. When we come back, how are the farming community responding to all this? What about Doge in the post office? Garrett Hawkins and Missouri Farm Bureau president in a moment. Then Adam Hunter will be in. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
We've got to get to the bottom of what's been going on with postal leadership. And, you know, frankly, I'd be pretty irritated, too, if I were a postal worker, and I could tell you for sure who's frustrated. And those are Missouri constituents who can't get their mail. And that is happening all over the state. The postmaster, Louis DeJoy, has resigned. I have to say, I think that's overdue. And there need to be some big changes at the top in that organization. They have missed their delivery metrics every single year that DeJoy was postmaster. We've seen mail delivery in our state suffer.
So that was Senator Josh Hawley talking about what's going on at the post office. It's a money loser, and the president wants to revisit it. Is that something we should be looking at? What has Doge discovered? Garrett Hawkins joins us now. He's a Missouri Farm Bureau president, but he sent to Doge, he was working with Doge, and told him about the problems with the post office. And the letter comes on the heels on Josh Hawley's statements and Eric Schmidt backing him up. Garrett joins us now. Garrett, is this fixable?
It is fixable. And certainly, Brian, I don't think it's fair to pit those that live in urban areas against those of us that live and work in rural areas. This is an American issue. We are all taxpayers and deserve prompt, reliable service from the United States Postal Service. And unfortunately, can't seem to get the attention of the leadership of USPS. So now I'm asking Mr. Musk and Doge to do what they can to really take a hard look at what's happening.
We know even on its best day, it's losing a ton of money, and its competition with FedEx and U.S. And UPS outperforms them regularly.
Yes, it does. But I mean, you know, Brian, the frustrating part is if folks take a look, last fall, the previous Postmaster General opened up a 7-day comment period over Labor Day weekend, mind you, to seek public input for their Delivering for America plan. A component of that is the regional transportation optimization, which is code for we're going to speed service in urban areas to the detriment of those of us that live more than 50 miles from a processing center, which would be the vast majority of Missouri and, frankly, the vast majority of the country. So instead of a regional transportation optimization plan, it's really a really terrible outlook for rural America under this scenario.
So have they answered you, Doge?
No. Well, not yet. I'm hoping that we can get Mr. Musk's attention. Certainly, they have lots of irons in the fire as they look at waste, fraud, and abuse across government. But certainly, we believe the Postal Service is ripe for hard questions being asked. You know, we've opened up actually a portal on our website at MOFB.org so that our members and anyone in the public can provide their experiences. And I want to be clear, this is not about the hardworking men and women who are delivering our mail 6 days a week, rain, snow, or whatever. They're carrying out the job. This is an issue with leadership in Washington, D.C., and whatever's happening in processing centers across the country that are leading to significant delays, lost mail. I've had prescription drugs not just damaged, but completely pulverized when it's arrived to my home. We have people that are farm checks are getting lost. It's ridiculous, and something needs to be done.
Well, you know what's interesting is that that's the one thing I always fear, because my postmen, I know how hard they work. They're on their feet all day. Always in a good mood. I don't want to ever think that I diminish them, but I do walk into the post office sometime and think, we got to find a way to give these people some incentive. You know, the free market, something in the most menial job, if you think if you have a sense of ownership or something, you're going to approach it differently. If there was some type of free market involved with the post office, I think you might enhance performance. That's really why FedEx and UPS do better.
Well, I mean, I'm fortunate in my farming community of 1,100 people, you know, the post office is at the epicenter of town. Like, if you think about our communities, in order for us to do business, communicate with loved ones, right, receive important medications, that post office is critical. We're also fortunate that we actually have a UPS hub in town that is critical from a job creation standpoint, and obviously it serves our area well. But all we want are improved services that we're all paying for as taxpayers. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why service continues to go the opposite direction instead of improving.
So, Gary, let's go into your other area of expertise, and that's farming. How are the tariffs affecting you? What do you worry about?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, tariffs are, I equate, Brian, to a blunt force instrument, right? In agriculture, tariffs are difficult when it comes to trade because 96% of the world's consumers live somewhere besides here. The world marketplace is critical for our commodities as well as our finished ag products. At the same time, we also recognize that this president is trying to level the playing field like we've not seen before. For the previous 4 years, we essentially didn't have a trade agenda in this country, and now we see a president that is serious about bringing people to the table. So while tariffs are the, I guess I'd say, the sexy news item that captures everyone's attention, what we see also is this administration working on technical barriers to trade that oftentimes keep our corn, soybeans, our beef, our high-quality products out of markets. Take the European Union. They're a prime example. We take in twice as much as what they take from us, and it's not really because of tariffs. It's because of technical barriers that they put in place just to try to keep our ag products out. That's what excites me. While we have these bumps and challenges with tariffs, what excites me is this administration is focused on the big picture.
Right, but can you guys survive? I know you needed payouts in the farming community last time. Will that be the story again?
We did. And we've had that conversation with Secretary Rollins. She's doing a fantastic job. USDA is primed and ready to reactivate market facilitation program again, if and when that's needed. Congress will have to step up, I'm sure, and replenish those funds. I mean, Brian, this is a prime reason why Congress needs to do its job and also get a new farm bill passed. That is a food security bill for America, as well as a risk management tool for farmers and ranchers. So that is the big ticket that needs to get done. In the meantime, the administration led by USDA needs to be ready to help us as we navigate these uncertain times.
Senator Josh Hawley, Eric Schmidt, calling for an audit of the post office, and Garrett Hawkins also working hard for farmers in Missouri and around the country. Garrett, thanks so much. Garrett Hawkins, appreciate it. Adam Hunter next.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It causes uncertainty. It causes uncertainty in the commercial market. Large companies aren't committing to long leases. It causes tremendous uncertainty in the buyer market, buying new homes, buying old homes. Right now, last month, we had almost 14% of all contracts fall apart, which is very unusual. Wow. Last time we saw that was right on the heels of COVID. People got scared, but then the market came back by storm. But that's exactly what's going to happen here. We have so much hesitation in the market, and it's giving us an opportunity for buyers to make a good deal.
That's pretty cool. We haven't had that in a while. Barbara Corcoran of, you know, Shark Tank. She's founder of the Corcoran Group. Talking to you, she said that on Fox and Friends about an hour ago. So I think it's about 2 hours ago. And I think that's kind of interesting because with everything, there's opportunity. And investors know that, too. And you see some of the big, the Mag 7, all of a sudden, I can't afford that. I can't afford that. All of a sudden, well, came down a little bit. And if you could have jumped last week, now we've seen that the market's up another 300 points. So I think it's 404 days in a row where the market's up. But Scott Bessent was talking yesterday, and people universally respect him. They like Mnuchin, but they really like Bessent. And one of Scott's things that he said when he was here before he was Treasury Secretary, and he's a billionaire essentially, and he talked about when he was growing up that he had a lot of money and his dad lost his job and then they all had to go back to work and they all had to help out because they lost everything. So he always has an eye on Main Street, even though technically he's on Wall Street. And he says this is his focus. Cut 30.
In the U.S., we've had this incredible boom on Wall Street. I think Wall Street can continue doing well. But I think it's Main Street's turn to share in the prosperity. And I think it was the pullback by the small banks, the post the GFC, that's kind of created this stagnation on Main Street. And we're determined to fix that.
And that's what the trade deals are about, providing the jobs opportunity, bringing the workers here, rebalancing trade. So you have cheap prices, but we also have national security, too, because when it comes to rare earth, when it comes to steel, if you can't make your own medicine, I think we have an issue, don't you think? Cut 29.
In response to President Trump's tariff announcements, more than 100 countries have approached us, wanting to help rebalance global trade. These countries have responded openly and positively to the president's actions to create a more balanced international system. We are engaged in meaningful discussions and look forward to talking with others.
So, and there's like 15 to 18 ready to go right now. And I think, I just wish Scott, I hope his trade staff is big enough to have every room pulsating with the Norway deal, the Saudi deal, the South Korean deal, the Vietnam deal. Pump them out. These are not treaties. They're deals. They're arrangements. So then you're going to see the market go up, but then you're actually going to see things happening rapidly. That's why I think they have every reason to be confident about the midterms, because they're cutting regulations. They're expanding energy. That feeds into the economy anyway. And then you have all this growth that could happen with the extension of the tax cuts and the new spending that's out there, as well as what Doge has saved. The big, beautiful bill is what I'm referring to. And then what happens with these new trade deals. Ultimately, it's with China. China feels like the more they dig in, the stronger they look, the better they go. And when the U.S. comes out and what Trump said is, you know, we'll do a deal with them soon, they look at that as they're winning. That's Donald Trump being Donald Trump. You know, they pride themselves on knowing our leaders and doing the psychological profile. I'm just shocked at how many people say they know Trump but don't know Trump. And I think the other one that's going to be shocked is Vladimir Putin. Again, he just ripped – President Trump just ripped Vladimir Putin. And even though he was going after Zelensky last night. So people who think that he's just a pro-Russia guy – it's because you only want to hear your narrative. So Kevin Hassett was on with Laura Ingraham last night. So I just said, in the big picture, the market's got to respond. They're really looking at what's happening with China. Cut 22.
We're very optimistic about China and especially optimistic about just about everybody else. You know, we announced that we've got basically an outline of a deal with India. And that's especially interesting because if you think about the countries, we talked about non-tariff barriers and tariffs that are harming American workers. If you think about the countries that have really been about the worst offenders over time, India's right near the top of the list. And the fact that we've got a sketch of a fantastic deal already in place with India means that the president is showing leadership to the world.
So he was much more optimistic last night. And I asked him, you know, he was up until a minute before he came on. They said, Brian, how much time, how can you tap dance? And I said, why? Well, he's not here yet. And we're waiting for him to walk to the camera at the White House. So 1 minute before, they said he's there. And I couldn't talk to him before. I usually like to. And I said, where were you? He said, I literally hung up the phone on a deal while to walk out to you. And I'm going right back to the phone to work on this deal. And we know that J.D. Vance was just in India working on an extremely important deal for 3 days. We know that he followed up with Maloney in Italy, that literally the next day in Italy after the president broke the ice with her. So that's why Trump says Jay Powell's going to stay. That helped the market. And the other thing, he came back and said, we're going to get a deal with China. And on some level, we are speaking already. And that helped the market. But I do think that he needs to see, to be consistent, the precursors to the fentanyl that's killing so many young people in America. They all come from China. He stops everything in its tracks. Why can't you stop that? That's why you put the 25% tariffs on to begin with. Then you added it on at the end. So to me, show some improvement when it comes to fentanyl. That would be something good for the whole country. And again, it's for the parents. The Treasury chief floated the possibility of de-escalating with Beijing by going from 145% tariffs now and dropping it down to maybe 110, showing going in the right direction. So I'm reading all these international news stories, and one coming from Chinese officials is, because of their insecurity, my view, they need to see the U.S. move first. Now, I'm not sure that Trump, that's in Trump's DNA to move first. But the White House considered slashing the China tariffs. Then Trump came back and said, no, we're not going to do that. But Carol Ann Leavitt did find the cameras. To their credit, they always find the cameras. And said the Trump administration has received 18 proposals and meeting with 34 countries. So pretty cool. It doesn't stop Democratic cities from suing us, suing the federal government, including New York, Kathy Hochul, Letitia James, arch enemies of this president, doing nothing to secure the lobby of Trump Tower. By the way, yesterday it was graffitied again. She writes this, does our ridiculous Governor Hochul. President Trump's reckless tariffs have skyrocketed costs for consumers, unleashed economic chaos across the country. New York is standing up to fight back against the largest federal tax hike in American history. What are you talking about? Same people that say, well, he's cutting Social Security, he's cutting Medicare. What do you even, you just make stuff up. But the real focus right now, Trump this weekend is going to be looking at Iran. He's going to be traveling to Oman is where the Iranian negotiations are going to take place. Traveling to the Vatican for the funeral of Benedict was alive, stepped aside, then Pope Francis stepped in. I think they did a movie about that. So he's going to go. He says a lot of Catholics voted for him. He's going to show up. That's great. He's going to come back, and he's going to go to Saudi Arabia next. But I think by that time, we'll know if Iran is going to happen or not. But a lot of the focus is on Ukraine and Russia taking place in London. You got France, the UK, Germany, the US, all playing a role there. But you only have General Kellogg representing the U.S. delegation, which is fine, but it's not the Secretary of State. They're both, he and Witkoff, are boycotting. They're not ready to do it yet. But here's what General Jack Keane said, who does the Institute for Study of War. Cut 18.
Russia doesn't get these four oblasts total control over them, which is what they want. They don't have total control of them. They're not occupying all the territories in all four of them. In Luhansk, they occupy most of the territory, for sure. And if that doesn't happen, in other words, freeze where you are, establish a demilitarized zone for about 15 kilometers or so, bring in some forces, independent forces, to monitor that, that's kind of step one. And if we can agree on that, and obviously there's a ceasefire commensurate with that, that is progress. And hopefully that's what's on the table. There are other parts of this. It starts to get more complicated, to be sure. But that's a very good starting point.
And for example, Donald Trump, who has not steeped in diplomacy, obviously, came out and said, they just got to give up on Crimea. And then when Zelensky said, we're never going to give up on Crimea, he says, well, you should have thought about that 2014 when they took it. Why didn't you do anything about it? They took it without firing a shot. I understand both what they're saying, but it was explained to me very effectively today with the former head of NATO, General Secretary of NATO, Stoltenberg. He said, for example, Brian, when it came to the Baltics, when the Soviet Union just absorbed those countries, we never acknowledged that Lithuania wasn't Lithuania, Latvia wasn't Latvia, Estonia wasn't Estonia. But we also acknowledged they were part of the Soviet Union. So they never gave up their identity. They never wanted to, but they were being dominated by Russia. When the Soviet Union falls apart, these countries split out on their own. They later would join NATO. And people blame that for the reason that Russia is so defensive about the region and invade so many countries like Georgia, Ukraine, infiltrate Moldova, and made Belarus a vassal state. They say the same thing. Now, Zelensky, getting Crimea back is not going to happen. Getting a lot of that land back is not going to happen. But it doesn't mean you ever give up. And for Zelensky not to have a rebellion in his own country, to say, I give up on Crimea, you can keep all the places you stole, that's not going to work. But what you do is you never acknowledge it. You say, we're going to have a ceasefire in the lines that are there. You establish security lines with using international forces as the ultimate tripwire to stop the consistent Russian invasion. And for Russia, I think that what they should get as an economic incentive is immediately back on the SWIFT system and to start doing deals with the U.S. again. We could offer that. And people might be critical of that. I'm not one of them would be critical of that. You got to offer them something. And then see if you can stop the belligerent behavior. They already lost a huge outlet in Syria. They're battling to stay, have a presence there. Iran has been diminished. So they've alienated Israel. They were famously, Israel would work both sides on that. Not anymore. They're providing all these weapons to Hamas and Hezbollah. Forget that. So we'll see what happens. But that's Trump right now, according to a Fox poll. He's got 40% on foreign policy. I don't know. You don't think this is light years better than Joe Biden? You don't see that Donald Trump is addressing all our problems at one time? Do you know he never even sat down, I don't think, with indirect talks with Iran, yet they were able to almost get a nuclear weapon under Joe Biden's regime? All right, when we come back, we'll take some calls, 1-866-408-7669. We'll also find out if you want to know more. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
In 2024, there was a 1% increase in U.S. births, but that increase was with Hispanic mothers and Asian mothers. So they don't seem to be concerned about that increase. They seem to be more concerned about a decrease in other populations.
Say it.
No, I but think I've said enough.
It's not based on that.
And so, well, it's just based on a study. And so the other thing,
but
have
they said that anywhere? I mean, I feel like
it's just fair to hope.
That this is to target only white families?
Oh, I didn't say that.
You have to read between the lines.
Everything this administration seems to be doing is telling people not to have children. Why not make sure that kids that we already have a shot at good schooling?
Right. That's not his ultimate focus. Do you not understand that he's spending all his time on education, or a lot of his time? That is the view. They're in an inimitable way. Everything you think to yourself, there's no way people can think that. We want you to hear it rather than read a transcript. So they actually believe when the president came out and noticed our population decrease and said, how do we get the birth rate up? Maybe in response to a question, we give people $5,000 if they have a kid, incentivized to grow the family. Hungary does something similar, by the way. The bigger the family, the more money you get, because they want to grow their Hungarian population. So they, of course, say Trump wants more white people. There's nothing to indicate that. He gets more black votes than any Republican in generations. He gets more Hispanic votes than, I think, Democrats, more young votes. So the days of going racist, sexist, they're done. Got the women vote, they're done. Doesn't hire women for powerful positions. Are you kidding? Look at the cabinet. So I'm just amazed. And like people clap. I mean, whoever goes in that audience is just ridiculous. So they got huge problems. David Hogg comes out. He's a deputy director of the DNC. He said, I'm going to use some of the $100 million I got. I'm going to start primarying what he thinks are bad Democrats. And then he got rebuked by the director saying, you better not do that or I'm going to suspend you. But he's got his own pack. So I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't really care how they get along, but I'm pretty amazed. Reince Priebus said right to his face on ABC this week without George Stephanopoulos, he said, if I was the director and you were my deputy director, I'd fire you. You'd be let go. So good luck, because David Hogg would take the squad, Bernie Sanders, everybody else, and then leave the established people who actually are more traditional, not that they exist anymore, Democrats. The other thing I wanted to share with you is Elizabeth Warren. She was on a podcast of a woman I've never seen before, but obviously it's a friendly podcast. She's having a good time. She's smiling. And she was called out. Listen to this.
Do you regret saying that President Biden had a mental acuity? He had a sharpness to him. You said that up until July of last year.
I said what I believe to be true.
And you think he was as sharp as you?
I said I had not seen decline. And I hadn't at that point.
You did not see any decline from 2024 Joe Biden to 2021 Joe Biden?
Not when I said that.
So it gets a little worse for her because, you know, if you're in a hostile situation, how dare you do this and try to marginalize a president? But when you have somebody on there asking just legitimate questions, what did you say? Why did you say that about Joe Biden's health? And then if your comeback is, well, that's what I believe. Well, there's four books out right now with quotes from Democrats saying they couldn't even leave him in a room by himself. Listen to the second half of this.
You know, the thing is, he was sharp. He was on his feet. I saw him live event. I had meetings with him a couple of times.
Senator, on his feet is not praise. He can speak in sentences is not praise.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Look, it is, the question is, what are we going to do now?
Okay.
No, it isn't. Is how dare you think, you believe I'm going to trust anything you say and the judgment after what you just admitted to, and we all knew were the facts, we just wanted you to admit to it. Anybody who was around Joe Biden knows he couldn't do the job, and they were all talking to each other about it, but they were willing to suffer, make us suffer with it, because there are more Democrats in this country than Republicans, and they thought, if I could just muddy up Donald Trump enough, he'll never get elected. All right, I will see you tonight on the 5. And don't forget One Nation Sunday at 10. And for everybody who's in Dayton, I want to see you June 21st. For everyone in Dallas, I want to see you August 23rd on stage with History, Liberty, and Laughs with Fox Nation. And then everybody in Richmond, I want to see you in September.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.